Okay, we come now to the last discussion in this section. Discussion 21, the leaders of the church. Withdrawal from the world and the church in service to the world. We want to say, give some time and attention to Jerome. I summarize his importance here. Number one, as you already know, I'm sure, he is the author of the Vulgate translation of the Bible into Latin. You recall that the center of the church has been in the Greek-speaking East, and the New Testament was written in Greek, not Latin. We had Tertullian who wrote in Latin, but for the first time with Jerome, you have a translation of the scriptures from the Greek into the Latin of the West, and of course the Latin Vulgate becomes the standard translation. Recall that it ended the question of canonicity of various books, and it became, was, and is the official translation of the Roman Catholic Church. Vulgate means simply common language. A vulgar language is the language of the everyday people as opposed to a scholarly language. Secondly, he was the central figure in the introduction of the ascetic life into Western Europe. We're going to talk about that in just a minute. Third, this is a summary now, his writings more than any of the other church fathers bring before us the general as well as the ecclesiastical life of his time. He's an important source for the life of the church and life in his time. He was a classical scholar who abandoned pagan learning for theology, much the way Ambrose had done, kind of much like Augustine had done. He was the ascetic. We have said time and again that asceticism is the growing way of life. He maintained, and I'll give you some examples of this in your syllabus, he maintained that holiness and the wedded state are antagonistic. He said, and I quote, "Marriage means crying children, clamoring servants, cooks and seamstresses, and anxiety about expense." You got to worry about paying the bills. Notice that, have you, Ron? Especially about the little children. "The master comes home to dinner. The wife flutters like a swallow all about the house to see that everything is in order and the meal ready to be served." They don't flutter much anymore. "Tell me, I pray, where in all this is any thought of God?" You can either be a godly man or you can be a husband, but you simply don't have time to be both. Just too distracting. In a letter to Eustochium, or Eustochium as some pronounce it, who's an aristocratic young lady, Jerome sets forth his ideas on marriage. I'll just give you some excerpts. He said to this young lady, "Do not court the company of married ladies or visit the houses of the highborn. Do not court the company you must also shun those who are widows from necessity and not from choice." Now what do you mean by that? Well, you see, widows who are, if they are widows because, not because they choose to be, then they're not very spiritual, so stay away from them. See, if they're widows from choice, then they're spiritual. You can consort with them. Well, that is, if they're, for one reason, they can't get married for one reason, whether they're too old or for whatever reason. So another reason, what he's saying is, if there's a widow who wants to get married but can't, but stay away from her. She's not very spiritual. See, the single state is a spiritual state. He says, "You must let your companions be women pale and thin with fasting." those on a diet, you see. Well, those who are ascetic, you see. "Let those who are wives," as you're already in the marriage state, "keep the place and the time that properly belongs to them. For me, virginity is consecrated in the persons of Mary and Jesus." He has the idea that Mary was the perpetual virginity of Mary. It's already well established. "Last of all, shun all men, especially clergymen." Stay away from men, especially Bible college students. Well, especially those clergymen who use perfumes freely. Can't trust those fellows. by the way, this is an example of, remember I said up here under my third point in my summary, that his writings certainly are a window into the time. Gives indication of some of the things that are going on. these dandies. He said, you know, when you get these clergymen who use perfume, they're the worst kind. Well, so that I give you some advice, of some insight into how Jerome thought. Well, Roman society was critical of his views. They didn't like it, concerning asceticism and austerity. So the Roman people wouldn't buy it, at least not the way he wanted to do it. So he left town. He got mad and left town. Went to Bethlehem, settled down in a cave. It was a monastery, but it was a monastery in a cave. By the way, he says he was in a cave near or next to the cave where Jesus was born. If you go to Holy Land today, you go to the cave where Jesus, the birthplace of Jesus, the shrine, the idea that it was in a cave came from Jerome. We don't know if that's really the place. But you understand that? The idea that it was a cave. Jerome was in a cave near there, and he located it. I don't know if it was accurate or not. He gave his life to writing and reading, and as a result became the greatest scholar in the ancient church. He was a greater scholar than Augustine. He was not as influential as Augustine, but he was a greater scholar than Augustine. He was a moralist, a controversial scholar, I indicate here, a commentator, a historian, which means if you've got a bright mind, you do nothing else, you can become pretty good with the books. Now, some months, you know, and so he did that. We come now to the expanding on this discussion of asceticism. We come to the subject of withdrawal from the world. This idea comes into the church during the age of the imperial state church. Withdrawal from the world. Yes. Yeah. He had a pretty high opinion of himself. That may have been part of the reason. He thought he should be the Bishop of Rome and didn't get the job. What about her? She was a nun. Jerome seems to have been straight, you know, in his asceticism. Well, we look at the move toward asceticism. Almost without exception, the leaders of the imperial state church were ascetic and promoted asceticism as the higher life. The tendency had begun in the ancient Catholic Church. You say, we don't meet this for the first time in the imperial state church. We meet it before 323, don't we? It's there. We meet it in the New Testament. It's a problem. Taste, touch not, taste not. Study that in your Bible classes. We trace here in our syllabus the development of asceticism into monasticism. And you can see that it would lead to it. In summary, let me say that monasticism became a dominant institution within the church. Later on, it became the dominant institution in the church, in the Roman Catholic Church. Monasticism rose in the East and spread to the West. Would we not expect that? The Greek way of thinking, the dualistic way of thinking, respectability of the invisible world and the suspectability of the physical world was a Greek idea, so we would expect it to move east to west. It reflected the Greek Platonic view of things, as we've said. We have to, one of the first individuals we can isolate and talk about who was very influential was Anthony of Alexandria, quite an interesting character. And if you read the history of monasticism, there's some good histories out, you start with Anthony. He was a young man in Alexandria, Egypt. And keep in mind, this is Alexandria where this idea first took firm root. It is northern Africa. He had inherited wealth and property. He went to church one day, and the preacher preached on the admonition of Jesus to the rich young ruler, "If you wish to be perfect, go and sell your possessions and give to the poor, and you shall have treasure in heaven, and come follow me." Well, he wanted to be perfect, so he did that. He sold most of his inheritance and gave it to the poor. He set up a fund to take care of a sister. His parents were dead. And then he went to church just a little bit later and heard a sermon on Take No Thought for Tomorrow from the Sermon on the Mount, so he sold everything she had and put her in a monastery. Well, not a monastery, put her in a Yeah, there was no such thing as a full-grown nunnery this time, but there was a society of an order that she could be a part of, and so he gave everything he had. But then he, following the ascetic mode, he withdrew into the desert, and he just lived off by himself, except that people would come out and talk to him. People had the idea back then, and often they were right, that these people who sat, like Jerome, you know, went off and lived in a cave or off by themselves and sat and read and thought, often could give good advice. There's something to be said for the retreat, for a meditation, you know. Say parenthetically, if you want something, very interesting experience sometime, you can carve out a chunk of your life, say for 2 weeks, where you can go off just by yourself. Very difficult to do if you can go off by yourself and neither eat nor speak for 2 weeks. Just, of course, drink water, but just fast and think. If you ever could do that, you'd never be the same again. I'm serious. And if you have anything to think with, if you got anything in your mind already there, you would have a different perspective on life. It is the kind of situation where it can, but it doesn't necessarily have to do it. It's not built in, but it can promote wisdom. It's really, look how many times we find ourselves in a mess because we just didn't take time to think, or have time to think. Well, the story is not all bad about these monks. And here people would come out for advice. Athanasius, remember Athanasius? The hero of the Nestorian conflict, I'm sorry, the Arian conflict, he wrote a story about Anthony. Anthony was quite a prominent figure. We wouldn't necessarily agree with what he did, but this book became, as I say here, something of a bestseller. It was a popular book, and it spread, did a great deal to popularize that way of life. Others begin to get the idea, and mainly because of this book, which Athanasius wrote about Anthony. So this brings us to the spread of monasticism, and it's quite an interesting story. You have those who were hermits who lived a solitary life. Eremitical monasticism. Circle the word eremitical. That's the first kind. Eremitical monasticism. That is the single hermit. And these fellows seem to be anxious to outdo each other in the practice of asceticism and austerity. That is, it was clearly a case of one-upmanship. To out Anthony, Anthony. To out Herod, Herod. As an example, one monk ate only once a week and slept standing up. He'll show him, you know, he's not going to live for the flesh. He's going to mortify the body and the deeds of it. He's going to be a spiritual person. One ate once a week and slept standing up. Many refused to bathe. They would cut their hair only once a year and they slept on the ground. it's a lousy way to live, quite literally. They became known for their being infested with bugs, by the way. Pardon? Yes. Well, they rejected that. You see, they didn't want to pamper the body by bathing it. Some would immure themselves. What's to immure yourself? Immure yourself, I pronounce it. To put yourself in a mural. What's a mural? It's a mural. It's not just a painting. It's a mural. The painting is painted on a wall rather than hung on a wall. A mural painted on a wall. Murus is the Latin word for wall. If you're immured, you're simply put yourself in walls. They would wall themselves in. Many would immure themselves in tiny cells, never seeing anyone, just sort of, you know, like have a bricklayer, just brick them in tiny cells and have their food put through a slot and pray and meditate and read and never see anybody the rest of their lives. Simon Stylites, who was one of the more famous ones, he was a forerunner of the pillar saints. He died in 459. He constructed a dirt column 6 feet high outside the city of Antioch and lived on it. He didn't put himself, see, if you put yourself inside a wall, you're out of the weather. He's going to do one step more. He had separate himself, but not build a little hut or a cave or a cubicle. He built a pillar and just climbed up on it and didn't come down. Later on, he was ashamed of his moderation. He built increasingly higher columns until he had one 60 feet high. He finally really got close to God. And he lived on top of that thing for 30 years. For 30 years, he lived up there, and it was only 3 feet across. I'm sorry, 3 feet in circumference. 3 feet in circumference, not diameter. Very small. He just lived there for 30 years. He had friends who would hand up food. He had a rope. And he had friends who would regularly, ever so often, hand him up food. People would come to talk to him. How did he sleep? Very carefully. He tied himself on. Yeah. Touch his forehead to his toes, yes. There were extreme punishment of the body, you know. He did that in case he got too comfortable.
Didn't have to do it.
Yeah. And by the way, to look at the other side of this, he was credited with many healings, whether he did or not, and he was credited with great wisdom. Heads of state would send emissaries out to get his advice on things. And usually it was exceedingly good advice. Well, he knew what was going on. He received information, word. He communicated. But he just stayed there for 30 years. He was really, when Jesus said, be not, you know, when the Bible says, love not the world, be not a part of the world, he wasn't a part of the world. He was 60 feet away from it. Eremitical monasticism was atypical in the long history of monasticism. It flourished only in Syria and Egypt. That is, these fellows were unusual. Those who would really practice the cruel kind of asceticism, that they were not standard. See, Anthony didn't do anything that bad. This was the lunatic fringe. Although it was not all funny, you know, it was a very serious thing. I mean, that's quite a feat, isn't it? Because you got to wonder if somebody's wrapped real tight, if they, you know, would do that. But an interesting concept of spirituality, isn't it? Then we come to Kenobitic monasticism, giving it the hard pronounce, the Latin hard C sound. Yes.
Is this change, in other words, is this just another form of it, or is this change into it?
No, this is another kind of monasticism. You have eremitical monasticism in Syria and Egypt. It was atypical. It was a minority movement. Anthony popularized it. Such men as Simon Stylites or Stylites, they perverted it, took it to extremes. There were many of them, but it was not mainstream monasticism. Yes, it was just one man out by himself. But a more popular form was Kenobitic monasticism. Hermits began to locate their cells, caves, and hideaways in loose communities called the Laura. The Laura was a these were hermits. These were not walling themselves in. They were not practicing the extremes of Simon and or even Anthony. They would live an ascetic life, a lot of fasting, a lot of praying, but they begin to locate themselves together in loose communities. The collection of monks would have a loose set of rules. Often they would agree upon a leader. Didn't always do that, though. The Laura, this community of monks, which is what the Kenobitic monasticism is, kind of communal monasticism, which is a loose collection of individuals. The Laura evolved into a community or monastery governed by a head monk and by strict rules, but it evolved into the monastic system. Before his death in 346, Pachomius had established 9 monasteries of men and 1 of women. After his death, other foundations continued, continued to be made in all parts of Egypt. Then we have Basilian monasticism, named after Basil of Cappadocia, and now it is, you see the evolution, you have the individual, then you have the loose community of individuals. Yes. Kenobitic. No, he's an example of it. I put him in there. Pacomius, he's an example of a leader in the Kenobitic monastic movement. You see, this is an evolutionary process. Arimatico, Kenobitic. Then you have a genuine monastery. Basil of Cappadocia, for whom Basilian monasticism is named, of course, lived for a while as a monk, but he returned to the active life of the church. And it really wasn't for him. He set forth rules, however, that became the standard of monasticism in both the East and the West. He did away with the extreme destructive forms of asceticism. Because you're not really doing God a big favor by touching your head to your toes or not bathing. That really just doesn't honor God particularly. But it emphasized mutual edification and useful work on behalf of the church, which, by the way, is still the general monastic theme. Instead of, that is, yes, be a monk, live, have a community, but live with other monks, follow the rules, but don't just sit and speculate and stare at the stars and pray. Do that, but also do something useful. Basil's rule is still the standard of the Eastern Church, and in a modified form, the standard for the Western Church, which brings us to Benedictine monasticism. Now, Basilian monasticism was a firming up of this process, but it was predominated in the East, still does. But in the West, it was Benedictine monasticism, named after Benedict, after the year 500. And he adapted the monastic ideal to the conditions of the Western races. You see, these barbarians in the West weren't as good at that kind of at asceticism as the people in the East. They didn't have as long tradition. In other words, in the East, it was long held that if you were the good life was the austere life. In the West, it was eat, drink, and be merry. Now, that's oversimplification, but people in the West were not as acculturated to that kind of thinking as many people were in the East. Benedict of Nursia founded a monastery south of Rome, as I indicate here, and I list here for you the basic framework of the Benedictine rule. First of all, the novitiate was established. You see, what happened is that, Benedict realized, especially in the West, you had people who were like the kids at church camp, who often dedicate their lives to full-time Christian service when they're a little bit young to do that, and then later on they find it's not for them, and then they have guilt. He realized that people would take a monastic vow under spooky existential conditions, like Martin Luther did, for instance, later. Get scared, or in a moment of trauma, in a moment of deep depression, some real problem comes up, take the monastic vow. Well, then you're stuck with it. And some of the monasteries were being troubled by the fact that there were too many people in them who really were not cut out for that way of living. But they had taken the vow. And so he, versus, if you're going to have that kind of system, because we reject the basic thesis of it, but he said there ought to be a novitiate, a two-year period before the vows were taken. Ray, you have a question? No. Sometime later on, the abbot, the head of the monastery, could let them out of it. But that was extreme. The general principle was that once you took the vow, you were there. You were in. So, the novitiate had a two-year period to live the life of a monk before he took the vow. See if he was cut out for it. And then, again, that's common sense. Once the vows were taken, however, the decision was final, and the monk could be released only by a special act of the church. The threefold vow, you ought to know this, good test question possibly, threefold vow, poverty, chastity, and obedience. Absolute poverty, that you couldn't own anything. When you came to the monastery, you gave everything you had to the poor or to the monastery, all your goods.
monastery gave you something to wear, and you had everything was belonged to the king. It was real communism. Everything belonged to the group, to the monastery. Absolute poverty, celibacy or chastity. If you had a wife, you left her behind. Of course, you did not marry. And obedience to the abbot. Absolute obedience to the abbot. By the way, this third factor we're going to see looking ahead, and we'll discuss this at length. This is one of the reasons why the monastery came to be the dominant institution in the church. Because they practiced absolute obedience to the abbot, an authoritarian system. They got a lot done. Because the word of the abbot was absolute, was the word of God. It was absolute obedience, no matter what. Yes. Abbot's from the Latin word for father. Not Latin word, it's the Aramaic word. Abba, we cry Abba, father. The abbot was the father of it. And the... Well, poverty, chastity, and obedience. The laws of worship under Benedict, there were seven periods of worship, including night watches. Seven times a day you would go to worship. And it included getting up in the middle of the night. There were laws of work. Physical labor, the monasteries were to be self-supporting. Mental labor, they were just, you had to work, you had to raise your food, you had to study. And including the copying of literary works, and you well know that many of our great manuscripts came from the monasteries. All the great uncials did. Let me summarize monasticism as a whole. We're going to see it again, okay? It's not the last time we're going to see it, but I want us to see that it's well established in the period of the Imperial State Church. First of all, the monastery became the characteristic institution of the Roman Catholic Church. I've already said this. It absorbed the lives of the most dedicated men and women. Interestingly enough, one of the reasons why the Roman Church did not make many more progress than we might have thought it could have in certain areas was that the best people, the best minds, ended up in monasteries. The great leaders, the best people tended to become monks, not bishops. The monastic movement was a reflection of an idea, secondly, that the world was hopeless, the higher life could only be found in physical flight from the allurements of the world, and that voluntary hardship made one more acceptable to God because it was the ultimate denial of the flesh. That statement sort of summarizes the idea of monasticism. It was the monks, therefore, rather than the bishops, who were the missionaries, teachers, scholars, and theologians of the following ages. Brother Martin Luther was a monk, you see. When Western Europe, I point out here, sunk into chaos and darkness, it was the monks who kept alive the embers of Latin civilization and later fanned them into a blaze. When the official church had lost its soul, it was the monks who kept alive the spiritual concepts of historic Christianity. In the Dark Ages, we're going to see the single light of what learning there was in the monastery. Now, not all monasteries. Monasteries, we're going to see, tended to suffer a cyclical fate. That is, they tended to reform, become wealthy, become corrupt, then reform, and because they were reformed, become wealthy again and corrupt. So not all monasteries at all times. I'm not saying that. Well, this is our introduction to monasticism. Yes?
Number one, between the characteristics,
a little bit more about the monastic. Well, if you wanted to... It summarized what Roman Catholicism was all about, the ideas. That is, for instance, the monk was the highest model. He was on his way to sainthood. It was the best, the ultimate. They all had the concept of lower and higher Christianity. If you get into higher Christianity, you had the clergy, but the clergy was the highest class. And among the clergy, the highest was the monk. It was Catholicism practiced to perfection. And always has been, by the way. You see, if you're going to get married and have kids, okay. But just admit that you're a second-class or third-class Christian. The best Catholic is the ascetic, chaste, obedient person. And the monastery embodied that. And, by the way, it became the leading force. It became
That's where most of the wealth was. They ended up owning most of the land. It was just the dominant institution in the Roman Catholic Church. By the way, looking ahead, this idea that this was that the monk, that there arose later on in the next age, the theory or the superstition that if you were buried in a monk's cowl, you know what a cowl is, the hooded garment, if you were buried in that, you automatically stayed out of purgatory. That was your passport to instant heaven. And as a result, a lot of noblemen who were pretty sure they owed God quite a bit of penalty would often have themselves buried in a monk's cowl, just in case, you know, wouldn't hurt, you know, maybe could fool St. Peter. But at least it was worth a try. The church never said that would get you by. You know, if you weren't a monk, they'd be married in a monk's cowl. A lot of them do. That won't hurt to try, you know. And the church said, we'll let you be buried in a monk's cowl for several thousand dollars. And they hope for the best. You won't hurt to try. You know. Well, anyway, which my point is that the monk was the ideal. Not that they always lived up to the standard, but that theoretically it was. The last thing we discussed in this whole in section two is the church in service to the world. After Constantine, the church, despite the encouragements of Augustine and his City of God, the church was not able to build a Christian society. Too much paganism. We've already looked at that. But there were areas of progress toward the ideal. The church did help to raise the moral tone of society. And keep in mind, especially in the West, it was a very barbaric society. And we're going to look at this again in the Middle Ages. The new ethic called for, that is, versus the old ethic of classical virtues of pride, strength, honor, and courage. The new ethic did call for kindness, obedience, humility, patience, mercy, purity, chastity, and tenderness. You look at these monks, whether they're all the way from the beginning, the Eremitic monasticism right straight through to Benedictine monasticism. We may not agree. We may think that these are theological, that this is a lot of theological silliness, but we cannot help but admire the kind of the resolution, the kind of dedication, misguided, misinformed, albeit. We can't help but help admire people who would pay such a price. And it did have a softening effect upon the barbarianism, especially in the West. These virtues moderated the violence of a failing world. Didn't stop it. It did have an effect, and we're going to take up this strain again. The church took a stand against and for the most part eradicated, here were areas of success, almost categorical success. Abortion became almost unheard of. Child exposure, we talked about that. The gladiatorial shows, which was a dominant character of Roman pagan life, they were simply put out of business. They went and were gone, never to return. The church implanted a humane spirit in Roman legislation during the declining decades and centuries of the Roman Empire. They limited patria potestas. What is that? The absolute power of the father to put his children to death if he chose. Under old Roman law, patria potestas, if the father wanted to execute his own children, he had to answer to no one. Well, the church stopped that, limited it. He couldn't just do it without being responsible or answerable in any way. A new concept of womanhood was codified in Roman law. An interesting thing. Let's do the modern women's liberation movement, and I'm not for the ERA. Doesn't mean I'm right. But I think that the women's liberation movement is saying some many important things and many good things. I think they're saying some bad things, too. But the point I want to make here is, I hope you ladies realize that this thing of women's rights is anything but new. In fact, you go back to the 19th century, you find it articulated very well. Susan Anthony and others. But you go all the way back to these early Christian centuries. It was an issue. We should not be surprised to see this. The concept of womanhood was elevated in Roman law. we don't have time to go into details. Implanted in Roman legislation was the right of the poor to judicial appeal, not just the wealthy. Sunday legislation we've already met, and the humane treatment of prisoners. The idea that a prisoner was forfeited all rights to being treated like anything but an animal. And by the way, one of the reasons the church stopped that is that up till Constantine, so many Christians knew what it was to be a prisoner, didn't they? And they've been on the other side of this thing. And so the humane treatment. Now, the laws did not call for humane treatment as we might think of humane, but it was humane in comparison to what they did have. So those are examples, and this is the whole subject in and of itself. But the church did have a very positive and a very significant influence in these areas and other areas. The next point I make is that the church developed philanthropy. For the first time in the history of the world, there came into existence a system of organized charity. Now, the Augustine Rome had a welfare state, but it was not organized charity in this sense. The welfare state was simply the right of every Roman citizen to not starve to death. But for the first time, you have the institutionalizing of benevolence. You have hospitals. The church did this. Always has. You have orphanages. Remember I've already in the first century, the Christians would go get the babies where they were at the exposure locations, so they wouldn't die or be sold into slavery or be raised as prostitutes. And the idea of taking care of the children. Keep in mind that it was orphans were they were much more numerous than they are now. People died easier, quicker. By the way, you see, when you find when a woman dies and she's still got children, and we think that's, we're sort of offended by it. It's unusual to us, especially. How many orphans do you know who are orphans in the sense that both parents have died? That is, not a divorce, you know, and not the parents haven't gone off and left them, but both parents have died. I imagine some of you don't know any. Is there anybody that doesn't know a single, can name a single child as an orphan because both parents are dead? Very unusual, isn't it? You may know one or two, but, it's not very many. But you understand the first century, these early Christian centuries, this period of the history of the world, there would be hundreds. People died of almost anything. And so it was very common to have children who simply had nowhere to go. And the church took care of this. Homes of refuge for the destitute. Remember we talked about how the church would go out in the mornings and bury the dead, for the poor who had died during the night, the Christians would. And those who were simply destitute, the church took the teaching of Jesus very seriously. And keep in mind, let me say this, that this is kind of strange to us. We are not as much given to caring for the poor. The American church isn't. Part of it's our fault, and part of it isn't. You see, for one thing, the Christian ideals have been embodied in social legislation, so that you end up supporting the poor if you pay taxes. Do we not? If you pay, well, you do. But they're genuinely poor. Those are actually starving to death. They are not, we do not see them as much. For two reasons. Part of it's our fault, part of it isn't. The really abject poor, we don't see them. First of all, we don't look for them. But secondly, we have the best dressed poverty in the world, and we do not find our streets full of people who are starving to death. Well, there was how many of you on the way to school this morning walked by two or three people who simply are starving to death? You just don't do it. But in the ancient world, that was very common. They were everywhere. It was more of a visible. It was more visible. Now, I'm not trying to get us off the hook. But I'm simply saying that it was a different world. And but I do think that the church, the conservative church, the evangelical movement, is giving attention now to more social concern, and I think it's a good movement. I'm for it. See, Jesus, you look in the prophets, look in the teachings of Jesus, how much is said about the poor. Well, the early church took this to heart. And by the Roman Catholic Church has a long and honorable tradition of caring for the poor and caring for children. It started way back then. In fact, I think this is one of the areas where the Roman Catholic Church has always stayed ahead of Protestantism. We never have caught up. Very often you get somebody who's really down and out. Where do you send them? To the Salvation Army or to the Roman Catholics? In many communities. Isn't that right? Because they're the only ones who are organized for this. Well, this came into the tradition of the church very early. Question? To hand? Okay, the last thing. Let me summarize this. The church in service to the world. First of all, the church took the lead in progressive social endeavor. It really did. And it always has, by the way. It always has. But secondly, the church preserved culture and civilization, mainly through the monasteries, but not only through the monasteries, when the Roman Empire disintegrated. The churches were the only islands of culture in a flood of barbarism. And sometimes, you look in the Middle Ages, we're going to see the kind of situation that would lead us to say the church was almost inundated. The church almost went under. Its culture almost went under. But not quite. The literature was still there. The ideas were still there. And sometimes, and in some of this disintegration of the Roman Empire, the church was guilty. Sometimes it was the victim. The church did have a heavy influence. It did ameliorate the rising tide of darkness, ignorance, anarchy, violence, undiluted barbarism. Have any questions? Well, this brings us to the end of this section. And as I gave you the take-home exam and the stipulations for it, keep in mind, you'll have to have the same kind of, it's the same kind of test. I don't have an essay question at the end. It's the same kind of test that you had over section one. You should fill in the, I'll just tell you what it has. Of course, you're not to look at it until you actually sit down with the witnesses to take it. Just stick it back in your folder. This is the honor system. It has 20 true and false. It has 10 where you define or identify, as you did before. It has 20 listing or just listing. Where you list some of the things I listed in the syllabus. We have 2 minutes. Okay, so it's the same kind of test, and I think you're a little better prepared for. Some of you need to be a little better prepared for it this time than you were last time. Okay, any questions? Well, let's glance in your syllabus at what we're looking at next to get our minds headed in that direction. Section 3, the church in the early Middle Ages, 605 to 1122. The church in the early Middle Ages, this is a fairly short section. And then section 4 will be the church in the later Middle Ages, 1122 through 1500, the end of this course. So this is where we're going, and it'll be the same kind of approach. Take this chunk of time, and we're going to talk about the church in the early Middle Ages, do it topically again. Yes? Yes. You're reading. You should be done for it. Done. If you're caught up today, the reading is done.
So the 31st page is for Wednesday.
Yeah. Oh. That's quite a large assignment. I'll give you some time on the reading assignment for Wednesday. It's quite a large assignment. You're going to be taking your test. Tell you what I'll do.